woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Oh. Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Lord won't bake stacks and jacks. After my Ricky on the board, SP Futures down 6. NASDAQ Futures down 17. So we're leaking a little bit here today. Yesterday was a very odd day with the court decision and then the markets run up with the no tariffs. Then as tariffs kind of came back, we went right back down again. I think the term would be bizarre world, but not so sure that's all that descriptive. But we have Professor Kevin.
Good morning.
How are you, bud? You feeling better? 100%?
No, I'm not 100%. I'm marginal, but I'm awake.
All right, well, there you go.
What more do we need to know?
Why don't you 100% as much as that is these days?
Well, you know, this may be the first time in my life I've felt my age.
You'll pop back. I think you should take.
I'll be back. Yeah, I'll definitely be back. It's just, you know, this is just lingering.
Well, you're not taking the cure.
Yeah, I know. You keep telling me about the cure. My stomach keeps saying that doesn't sound very good.
Well, the hot tea and the lemon and the honey is good. You could lay off the booze.
Yeah, I have been known to have some hot tea this week. So.
Yeah, boy. It's hard to keep up with the news, Kevin. I didn't know that it was all that bullish, the tariffs going down, and all of a sudden they're back and we're down the other way. I was on Joel's broadcast or podcast yesterday, and they were asking me about the market, and I said, other than maybe the Gulf War, maybe, I don't know when we've had so damn many balls in the air in terms of what's going on with the economy, local and worldwide, and the more you look, the more they're just sort of there. I mean, I was looking today, being the monetarist knucklehead that I am, I saw this thing this morning, a little bit of a headline. India's economy grew by faster than expected 7.4% in the fourth quarter. March quarter. They were expecting 6.7%. Now, if you're just a headline grabber, whatever you are, that would probably seem pretty decent, doesn't it, Kevin? So I dig into the M2 growth in India, which is the growth in money. Now, how much money you pour in and how much inflation you may have, obviously is a lot determined by how much money that you pour into the system or take out or whatever you do. So I've got them growing. The M2 in the last year grew at 9.4%. All right, so right away my question is, what's the real growth? Is the real growth 16 and they subtracted 9? I doubt that. Do you? So then the last 2 months, they have poured money into the system. Guess what their annual growth rate of the last 2 months is?
17%.
29%.
Okay.
In the last 3 months, it's 12.
A number out of the sky.
Yeah, so I mean, how do you have any idea what this growth number is if you're pouring money into the place at that rate? It's like us during COVID. God, we were doing great. No, we weren't. Nobody's even working. I mean,
I don't remember anybody thinking we were doing great either.
Well, I mean, are we in a recession? Are we not? And they never even admitted to the 2 months down, right?
Although I think that was after they started opening things up again.
Well, that's my point. I mean, the whole idea is how. I mean, right now, the last month, we grew at an 8.1% rate, the money supply. How the hell are you ever going to, even if you have a recession, how are you ever going to define it if you aren't smart enough or aren't honest enough to essentially deflate your GDP by a like amount? And we're never going to do that. So no matter what it is, no matter who's in office, we're going to keep saying things are okay when they're not. I mean,
greatest economy ever, Tom.
Oh yeah, it says. what did Larry Kudlow used to say about George Bush's economy? The greatest story never told in the Goldilocks economy. And a month later, we collapsed. And in the end of 2008 or whatever it was, 2008, and 4 months later, Trump made him his head of economic advisors. Pretty interesting, huh?
Well, I think you got your sequence wrong. If he was talking about the Bush economy.
Yeah, well, I'm saying, well, it was 8 years later that he made him the head of the, as soon as he got in office, he became the head of his economic advisors, right?
Yeah.
And he couldn't recognize the economy under Bush was absolutely going downhill? Or not the all the loans and stuff that were out there? How do you miss that?
People talked about real estate bubble for a long time.
Well, I mean it was more than just a bubble. It was dramatic amounts of money coming from Japan here, borrowed at like 2%, 2.5%. And by the way, the reason why I'm kind of telling this story is the article I was reading the other day regarding the reverse of the carry trade. Now, I have absolutely zero idea why this is called a carry trade, but I don't know if anybody knows why it's called that, but if you were to borrow money in Japan, which has traditionally been lower than here, say you borrow there at 2%, I mean, back up just a hair, you have to ask yourself, when the mortgages in 2007, 2008 were 6.5%, and they got amazingly oversubscribed, you might look in the mirror and say, self, why are people falling over themselves to get a 6.5% essentially interest rate when it's damn near normal for a mortgage? I mean, historically normal. I mean, it's not like it's 12 or 15, you know, where you're gonna sell your favorite old car if you have one and put it in the bank and make 12 or 15%. I mean, well, the answer is people can borrow in Japan 1 or 2%, bring it over here. So, Kevin, if you and I had, say, $1 million to throw together, I don't know what you charge, go over to Japan and borrow $100 million at 2%, I come here and buy mortgages, package mortgages at 6.5%, I'm going to say even you and I can make some dough doing that. However, when you turn around and repatriate your dollars back into yen, if you did the forward transaction of the yen 10 years from now or whenever is going to include that interest rate differential. So you essentially leave the third leg of the spread out. We're just not going to do that. We're going to think everything's going to be okay. So we're going to invest here in dollars, we're going to make our money, and when we have to go repay it in yen, we just assume it's going to work out okay. But that's known as the carry trade. So the only people that we had access probably to that kind of information are people in the Fed, probably people in the Treasury. I mean, you and I are never going to, I don't think there's any place, maybe Carl could find it, where we could figure out how much borrowing was being done in Japan and money coming over here. The reason why I mention this is an article the other day, I mentioned I think on Tuesday, that now the 30-year rates and 40-year rates in Japan are pushing 4-4.5%, to where a lot of this carry trade, the fear is it might start being unwound. I'm not saying this is the exact same dollars it was here in 2007, but the fact is, Japan has $3.7 trillion invested in other countries because interest rates outside of Japan are higher than Japan. But if it starts coming to a pack where Japan becomes competitive, and that money is, because they need it, because they're broke, and that money comes off essentially the world stage back to Japan, you know, Kevin, it's yet another ticking time bomb that we never knew we had, right? But how many of those are out there? Ticking time bombs that we don't even know about. Real estate values in China, you name it. And the fact is, none of them will probably be anything that affects you until one day maybe they do. It just, how many these little buried landmines are out there that people forgot from the last war? You can't go crazy thinking about it, but you also can't really ignore it either. When you see interest rates go up, and you see, what's the interest rate in India going to be? What's their inflation rate going to be? They're pouring money now. Is that going to affect other people? It probably affects at least a couple of countries around them. You think they're doing that because of the Pakistan thing? They're buying, pouring money in to buy munitions or what? I have no idea what's going on in India.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you about that either. I would imagine they are arming themselves a little more, so that would not surprise me.
Yeah, I wonder what, that's been out of the news for a couple of weeks now, hasn't it? First they were blowing each other up, and now I haven't heard boo of you.
I haven't either.
Amazing how stuff gets off the front page.
Actually, it's pretty good that the ceasefire is held as well as it has. In that, there was a skirmish right away, and everybody was afraid that would blow everything up again, and it didn't. So it's actually a pretty good thing.
Yeah, weren't you, stunned by the history that Lou was telling us that one day? How many sides we've been on in this in the last 30 years? We talk about a dance, huh?
Yeah.
One of these days I'm gonna get the stones to dive into this book that John Lee bought me, America's Presence in the Middle East from like 18 something till now, and all the different oil companies we did this for and that for, and how we backed this government and that government. I don't know, do I really even want to go into that? It has to be like a word salad.
Too depressing.
Yeah, it's got to be like too depressing. Anyway, what's not depressing is the Cubs. Or the Rockies are so depressing. The Cubs beat them at least, but
the Cubs actually didn't dominate them like you'd expect they did. But they don't give a lot of style points. They just give notches in the win column, so you don't throw any of those back.
Well, the last two games, the Rockies starting pitchers are pretty good. They might have a few young people that are decent.
Well, they might, and that's possibly something we saw. Also, cold night wind blowing in Wrigley Field is never a prescription for a lot of runs.
No, but
the Cubs executed. They didn't execute offensively very well, but their defense is so good.
Well, I think that's what won the two games. Plus, did you see the stolen base attempt by the Rockies guy? We were talking about that last night. There's two outs. There's a guy on first. It wasn't a 3-2 count. I think it might have been 2-2. No, it must have had to be a. One out, 3-2. So the runner takes off, and the telltale sign for whether it's a hit and run or a stolen base is the batter starts to look at home plate, right? Because if you're just stealing, you just put your head down and go. Not that I was ever much of a base stealer, but the guy keeps looking at home. The guy takes a fastball right down the middle, doesn't swing at it for strike three. They throw the guy out by, it had to be 20 feet. I've never seen that. And the batter gets up and he's just staring at the batter going, what the hell are you doing? What are you doing? I've never seen that where the guy comes in, instead of walking the dugout, he's just staring back at home plate, like walking to see the guy walking back to the dugout. Like, what are you doing, you idiot?
Well, and that kind of stuff, yes, I get the stare down. That's also the kind of stuff that's not indicative of a very together team.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing you get into the dugout, or you get, next opportunity, and that's when you start having conversation. Not on the field with a stare down.
Well, he just was, he kind of thought that when
it... I get the dismay. I get all of it.
Yeah. They've got a really beautiful... I've heard guys on the training floor went to that stadium and said it was pretty nice.
Yeah, it's been around for a long time. It's not a new ballpark or even close to it. Probably one of the older ones in the majors, excluding the Shrines. And yet, everybody, every time I hear somebody talk about it, they talk about how nice it is.
Well, I think they have the lowest beer prices. Actually, it was a challenge yesterday with beer prices in the major leagues, and it's the Cubs and the Sox are like, what are they, $14 or something? $12 maybe. And there's like there's several teams in the league that are under six, that are half priced. Coors Field being one of them. I think theirs is only like $4.50 for a Coors. How the Cubs and the Sox are way higher than the Mets and the Yankees.
Yeah, it's not like they're serving good beer or anything either.
No. The highest is I think Washington Nationals $14.50. And then the lowest is I think Coors Field $4.60. That's pretty much of a spread, isn't it?
It certainly is. You know, that is weird that they do it that way. I would probably tend to be a little on the high side if I were actually running a franchise, only because I really don't want a lot of really drunk people in my ballpark.
I don't know if this is much of a bet, but I'll bet since the game has gotten shorter, it's less of a problem.
Probably is. Haven't had anybody run out of the stands at the White Sox park.
There's nobody in the stands.
That's always been the one where they do it. Of course, yeah, nobody's there. So.
Yeah, nobody's there. What is the? So now the biggest deal in the city is what are they going to do for? They allegedly now are going to have a beer or a Pope thing there. There's going to be a mass. But now they've said that the Pope is not going to be there, but he's going to give some kind of a speech over the they're going to have a big screen or something.
And he's so you can pay to go in, get in there and see the video board.
It's only $5. It's only $5, but still, you can pay and go in. I think there might be a mass somebody else. If it's
probably not getting me to go drive over there for that.
Yeah, look at a load of this. This is 2025 numbers. The Tampa Bay Rays, which is at the Steinbrenner Field, is $15. Baltimore Orioles and Milwaukee Brewers are $5.
Yeah, well, the Rays are rebuilding their stadium post hurricane, so they're playing at the spring training park.
Why do you think they're playing at the Yankees one and not their own?
Yankees one probably has more seats.
All right. That was. You know what I'm kind of surprised about is the Oakland is playing in Sacramento. Well, the A's. They're playing in Sacramento, which is somebody else's AAA team. Their AAA team, while they're building a stadium in Vegas, is actually in Vegas. And I can't for the life of me figure out why they're not playing in their own AAA park. But they're not. I mean, there's a difference of about 1,000 seats, but I got to believe you can put those in temporarily, can't you?
It might have something to do with facilities too. The rest of the facility
could be, but wouldn't you think
how closely can you resemble a major league, clubhouse, under the stands, practice areas, all that kind of stuff?
Your first inclination would be to put it in your own place, or I mean, if I'm moving to Springfield, which I wouldn't, and I'm building a stadium, my first choice would be the Springfield AAA team if they have one, right? They start building a fan base. And what are you going to do in Sacramento for 3 years? Anyway,
they're going to suck.
Yeah, here's a real quick list. Baltimore Orioles, the highest, $10.99. Boston Red Sox, $10.50. White Sox, $10.50. Cubs, $10.49. They're down by a penny. Giants, $9. Pittsburgh Pirates, $8.91. Reds $7.50, Dodgers $7, Oakland Athletics $7, Yankees are only $6, so the Yankees are like $4 less than the Cubs. I would not have guessed that. Anyway, so then you've got where am I here? Texas Rangers $8, Phillies $7.70, Astros $7.50, Mets $7.50, Reds $7.50, Dodgers $7. Yankees are a buck and a half cheaper than the Mets. I'm really surprised at that. Tigers, $5.30. Cardinals, $5.25. Guardians, Royals, Mariners, Padres, Twins, all at $5. The Dodgers, $4.50. Diamondbacks are $5. Blue Jays $5 or $4.50. Rockies $3. Washington Nationals $3. So Washington's going the other way. Last year they were higher. Anyway, I can't believe that the Rockies and the Nationals are less than a third of the Sox and the Cubs. Why do the Sox think they deserve to be $10.50? And there's nobody there.
We've got to get some cash flow out of them.
I guess.
If you're crazy enough to go, you're crazy enough to pay $10.50 for a beer.
Yeah. Well, I did find out, as I've had this ongoing, I won't exactly call it an, that I like when I go, and one of my buddies got rid of his season tickets because they wouldn't give him a regular ticket that he could give to people, even though he offered to pay for them and actually did pay for them for a couple of years, $500, by the way. There's a bar on the south side of Loop here called Reggie's that on Sundays has a deal for Sox Park, where for $20 you go and you get a buffet, a ticket to the game, a bus ride over and back. Now the tickets are up in the nosebleeds, but it's for $20, and they actually give you a ticket. So they actually do have the capability of printing a ticket if they want to, Kevin. So when they say they don't do that anymore, that's not true. They do it for special occasions. So there.
Yeah, I forget the place I went a little ways from Wrigley Field that my daughter took me there for Father's Day, for a Father's Day game. I don't know if it was last year or the year before. It all blurs together, but they had a nice deal where they had a really, really nice brunch and then a bus ride, which was pretty sweet.
Well, cool. So what out of the sports news and out of the... by the way, you think those guys are going to get in the Hall of Fame next year? The veterans group is not going to meet till what, 2027? That's kind of a ways away.
So yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see who the hardcores are. Because I think there's still a lot of pushback about Pete Rose and gambling. And you got to remember, the guy bet on his own team when he was managing it.
Yeah.
And even if you bet on your team to win, that could easily cause you to make decisions that you wouldn't otherwise make that are not in the best interests of the team. For example, you know, is your reliever really not ready today? But put him in there. I need to ice this game, win my bet, and then he's not available for 3 days, or worse, you risk injury to him, and risk harm to a guy's career. So I still think that betting on his own team as a manager was very, very serious violation, and I think there's going to be some hardcores that feel the same way.
Yeah, what do you make of the steroid thing? Same thing.
They haven't been very forgiving so far, have they?
No, it's they've put people in that, in I think both of our estimation, I'm assuming agreement on this. I shouldn't really do that, but they put people in. Let's say that we're in a position that they should have known about it and did nothing. I'm Tony La Russa would be my number one child star in that one.
And Judge Landis never would have allowed that.
Right. Well, Judge Landis, I think, was kind of an odd duck, but. He was Mountain Landis because he was a big fat guy, right?
No, his name was Kennesaw Mountain Landis. I thought he was named after the mountain.
I thought it was a nickname, but maybe I could be wrong. I mean, I'm always wrong. But you know, I was kind of surprised that he. But he, you know, I guess he was in a time. It's hard to when you look at judgments people make. Sometimes it's hard to imagine the time they were in. I mean, everybody was, in those days, I mean, I got to believe that if you were done playing the White Sox here in Chicago and you had a game in New York, they hustled your ass as fast as they could to, you know, Inglewood Station or downtown and got you on the Broadway Limited so you could play in New York the next day, right? And everybody is on the same train, the reporters, the players, the gamblers, I mean, you name it. It wasn't I don't think they had private cars. If they did, it's the first I heard of it. So there was this, you know, whole group was like together, Kevin. I mean, we had the gentleman on the air when we first started the show. I think I have the book. I haven't read it. The original curse. was what, 1918, where they were, the guy said absolutely the Cubs threw a series against the Red Sox. And this was the second iteration, 1919. And I mean, these people were like all together. And if you go down the list of people that Mountain Land has banned, they were people that like were, I use the term, in the same hotel room, same train car, where the stuff was discussed. They were never even accused of being part of it or gotten any money, and they were banned as well. Almost like if it was the honor system? That they let it happen.
The honor code, yeah.
Yeah. And now, you know, you wonder if he was just, you know, the biggest ass that ever walked, some pompous ass, or whether it was so insidious in the game that anybody who, they wanted to deliver a message, that anybody even sees something like that is liable to be out of it. Now, if you and I weren't exactly there, you know, our judgment of what he did and how strict he was, you know, might be a little, it's like somebody who, instead of sitting there for a month in a jury listening to a case, immediately knows the jury was wrong, right, when they didn't listen to any of the evidence. And for us to go back and say, you know, we think he was way too strict, I don't know, Kevin. I mean, maybe if it was that bad at the time, it wasn't so strict. What do you think about something like that?
Well, I absolutely think that if you have to put it in the context of the era, and if the era was that ball games were getting fixed routinely and they had to put a stop to it, then he had to come crashing down on anybody and everybody. I am sure that was the mindset. And so it wasn't just about 1919. It was about 1918, 1917, 1916, all of those World Series as well, and numerous other games in the process. So, yeah, I think context goes a long way in this situation.
The only question maybe you and I might have, again speaking for you, is that if it was going on all over the place, to really zero in on, like, what was like seven or eight guys were on the one team, and nobody from any other team? That's a little weird.
Yeah, but it was the World Series, and people were talking.
Yeah, that's true. So anybody, there were a few guys on the list that we went through that, but just like even knew that a meeting took place, right? And you know, what do you make of the idea that Shoeless Joe, he hit three something something and didn't make an error. Jerome Holtzman, who I think was probably the best sports writer I ever read, he'd gotten to the point, Kevin, and you know more about this than me because you were a writer. He was able to write his article like a day or two late, right? I mean, the column in the, I believe, was it the Daily News? The column was in the wake of the news. In other words, he didn't have to hit a deadline that day for today's game. Mm-hmm. He was able to contemplate the story and essentially give the full version of whatever the story was a day or two later. So the column was really totally different than anything else you'd read in the sports page. And he did a lot of research on this, and I think his conclusion was that they had fixed the game, and that the first couple games they actually did fix. And because Shoeless Joe could have got a ball and he didn't get it and went for a triple, it wasn't an error, but normally, whatever. He had some instances, and then I think they, after two games, they didn't get paid or something. So then they said, well, we're not going to fix it anymore, and tried to win. And it was a 9-game series, and they almost came back, then they but didn't.
Yeah, but they were too far. It was too late.
Yeah, it was too late. Speaking of which, you think the Knicks have a chance after last night?
Yeah, if they win in Indianapolis, sure they do.
Is there that much to choose between the teams? Looks to me like Indianapolis a little deeper and a little younger. Is that just my impression?
Yeah, I honestly, from what I saw last night, what I've seen when I've done look-ins in the on the series throughout, is it really has a lot to do with Karl Anthony Towns, and when he is really taking the ball to the hoop all the time instead of standing outside and settling for threes, they are a different team. It's just a huge difference.
Yeah, they seem like they're more dependent on two people, him and the guard, than Indianapolis. But
yeah, and Indianapolis is sort of in a different boat in that they're just dependent on making their three-point shots. They take a lot of them. When they aren't hitting, it doesn't look very good, because basketball's always ugly when you can't shoot.
Yeah. Well, one of the issues that, you know, a lot of people seem to have, not just me, people I talk to with today's basketball and the three-point shot, is it totally screws up a lot of the games, to where if somehow you get down by 8 or 9 points, the mindset is you're only going to get back by shooting threes. So if you come down and you wing up 4 threes in a row and they don't go in, and the other guys come down and score, all of a sudden now you're down by 25 and the game's over. I mean, the amount of blowouts we've had in series that were pretty even, especially in the last game, I don't think I've ever seen that before, have you?
No, and what I saw last night was every time, you know, the Knicks came out hot, they stretched out a little bit of a lead. Indiana kept fighting back and getting within four or even three. And then they'd come down and just, they wouldn't run any offense. They'd just come down, first guy with any clearance to shoot from three-point range took it and missed. And Knicks would get out of the run, convert, and now it's back to 10. I think that what I look at with three-point shooting is, because I think it's fine, and obviously if you're a really good shooter, you should be shooting. It's the one, if you only have one skill in basketball and it's a good outside shot, you get to play. But the catch is, I always ask myself, would they have given you that shot at the end of the shot clock? And if the answer is yes, if they would have been happy to let you take that shot 6 steps or 6 feet behind the three-point line with the shot clock expiring, then why would you take it now? Work for a better shot.
Yeah, sometimes it's like the first guy over half-court shoots. It becomes very playgroundish. And it goes back to the billy ball stuff, Kevin. I think the base of all this is if you and I were good shooters, if we were to take a shot from 16 feet, which you'd call a medium range, but the free throw is what, 15? So roughly just by the free throw line, you and I might make that. If we're good, we're going to make that, what, 60% of the time? Mm-hmm. 55 or something? But the guy who's good from the three-point line might make it 40% of the time. Anyway, the math comes out that you're better off shooting from the three-point line because you're expected, you know, three versus two, and you put the percentage.
It's not a straight, you know, divided in thirds because of the incidence of long rebounds causing fast breaks and all that kind of stuff. But there is some math to it, yes.
But when you take that to the nth degree, to me there's a huge difference, but like you say, of a good shooter where he gets in his spot. Some of these guys have all the spots, but you get in his spot on the three-point line, and he's comfortable, he's there, he's got his feet set, and you get him the ball, and he's ready, and he shoots it. I think, you know, given today's ball, that's a very good play. It doesn't mean that you come off your dribble with a guy in your face and you wing one up from a million miles and you got the same percentage. And I think some people, I have to shoot a three. You know, and then that's when it sort of degrades. Plus, I've seen a couple guys come down on a fast break and stop and take a three. Now, I don't think the percentage is worth there to you. I got to be a layoff, it's about 99%.
They can. Again, it depends on the shooter, and it depends on, you know, can you catch and shoot in rhythm? And that's the other thing that comes into play with shooters is if you put the ball right, you know, right at my chest, where I don't have to step left, right, reach down, reach up, or anything like that, and I can just catch it and shoot in rhythm, percentage goes way up.
Yeah.
But how many times do you see a pass where, you know, guy's got to reach down into his thighs or below the waist? All of a sudden, that's an extra step for someone closing out on you. And that extra step means you know your shot is contested instead of wide open.
Okay, when we say we go to break, SP Futures down 450, NASDAQ Futures down 850. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 550. NASDAQ Futures down 1275. So we're kind of where we were, maybe a little bit higher than when the first tariff news hit the other night. And we were up, we were up like 50 points in the S&P and 300 or something in the NASDAQ. And now we're kind of right back where we started, which is, there's a year 10 that I never, from a court that I never even knew existed. DAX is up 229, it's 1%. European stock markets rise amid U.S. tariff uncertainty. Well, they're right about that. FTSE up 61.7%, CAC around up 24.3%. Some people were writing last night, they think the European markets are a better buy than ours right now. I don't know how you decide that. Or Nikkei down 467, that's 1.2%, so that's not so hot over there. Hang Seng down 283, 1.2%. Shanghai down 15.5%. Asia-Pacific markets fall as U.S. Appeals Court reinstates Trump tariffs. So it depends on your point of view, I guess. Bonds, unchanged, 4.43. They were up over 4.5 yesterday morning, and they came off. It was probably one of the reasons why the market was up yesterday as much as it was. But then, they were over 4.5, and now they're down 4.42. The Bund, 2.54, that's up 2 basis points. Japan unchanged, 1.50. Oil. The oil is up, it's up nothing. 4.43 unchanged. The Bund up 2 cents, 2.53. Wait a minute, I'm talking about bonds here. I'm going to word salad here this morning. The Bund is up 2 basis points, 2.53. Now the next one is oil. Oil is up 77 cents, 61.71. Still right in this bottom of the, between 60.5, 62.5, just kind of hanging in there. Brent up 50 cents, 64.65. Natural gas down a penny, 3.50. RBOB up a penny, 2.07. Gold, taking on the chin here a little this morning. Down 27 bucks, 32.90. Silver down 13 cents, 33.28. The gold and silver just wandering back and forth with the dollar. The dollar is dollar set for fifth monthly drop on trade fiscal uncertainty. Dollar is at 1.13, euros 1.13, British pound is 1.35, so not much going on there. Crypto, which has been on a tear, down 17 bucks, call that flat, 105.838. Ricky, what do you have for us, Traffic Weather Sports?
Hey, morning, Chief. It's currently 6:42 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. We're looking at 53 degrees right now with a high of 78, partly sunny and warm, becoming breezy this afternoon with a thunderstorm. Tonight, rainy as well, otherwise partly cloudy with a low of 51 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 66 degrees right now with a high of 105. Hot with periods of clouds and sunshine. Tonight will be clear to partly cloudy and warm with a low of 78 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Iman Kennedy from Monroe's looking at 23 minutes, 40 minutes. Iman Edens from Lynn Cook, inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 29 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 16 minutes. Lastly, inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan is about 29 minutes. Let's talk about sports real quick. NHL Conference Finals Game 5. Yesterday, Oilers beat Stars 6-3, winning the series 4-1 and gearing up for the Stanley Cup Final against Panthers next Wednesday, June 4th. NBA Conference Finals Game 5. Yesterday, Knicks beat Pacers 111-94, but Indiana still holding on to the lead with 3 wins against Knicks 2. Game 6 is tomorrow, Saturday, May 31st at 7 p.m. Lastly, MLB, today we got Reds at Cubs, 1:20 p.m., White Sox at Orioles, 6:05 p.m., and lastly, Nationals at Diamondbacks at 8:40 p.m. Back over to you guys.
Kevin, I had an email from a listener yesterday talking about the tariffs and their effect, and I don't think anybody has to spend a whole hell of a lot of time on this, but I think you do, as you walk through it, it's not an even sort of calculation, because it sort of depends on where the markup is. For instance, the example he used, if you bring in a Mercedes at, $100,000, I'll use $100,000 as the number, and you put a 25% tariff on it. If the Mercedes comes in at 100 and say the dealer sells it to you at 105. Now, I think that's an exaggeration, but the price is going to go up. Well, the tariff is going to be $25,000. Now, maybe Mercedes eats something, maybe the dealer eats a little bit, but it's a big number to you as a final purchaser. Now, of course, some of the Mercedes are assembled here. The parts pay. It's way more complicated than that, and I would think that there's probably more of a markup than 5% on a car, but I don't really know. But the man's point was, Nike probably charges, you know, $100 or more for a pair of basketball shoes. Not probably, they do. And his point is, if it comes in here at $10 and the tariff's 25%, you're talking about $2.50. So, you know, the shoe, instead of being $125, is going to be $127.50, assuming they don't. And it really, depending on where the markup is, you can't just look at the final price and say the tariff was 25% of that. And he's absolutely correct about that. So every product, you know, every markup, and then I've used that example before, and if we're going to, you know, we're going to try and stop foreign purchases of drugs, okay? And this is kind of the complaint that the court that struck this down, it's now back in, had, was that if you're trying to stop fentanyl, this is really a ridiculous way to try and do it. Anyway, that was their point. What I'm saying, Kevin, is if the penicillin shot you get in your behind or your arm in the hospital costs $200 in the hospital, but you're bringing in the penicillin from India at $1 and you put a 25% tariff on it, okay, it's a quarter. So it really, this gets way more complex than everybody just rounding it off and everybody's an expert. It's hard to be an expert unless you take every single product and look at where the markup is and what the price really is. I mean, it's how many people do you think even have an idea how complex this is?
I don't know. Anybody who studies supply chains does.
Well, yeah, how many people do that? How many people have you had in your class? 500 total? Well, no, you got all kinds of people, because you got them all on the Hollywood Squares thing all around the state, right?
Yeah. We have, you know, at any given time, we probably have about 600.
Is every class you do broadcast out like that, or some just with the people that are there?
I do a lot of in-person. I do mostly in-person, but we have some that broadcast out on Zoom. Some people take an asynchronous online. There's a little of this, a little of that.
But I mean, are there any...
If they're smart, they'll just take it from me, even if it's a Zoom version.
Well, so there. Do you have classes that aren't taped, or is everything taped?
No, it's not taped.
Okay, because I
deliver my content live.
No, I'm saying, can somebody listen to the lecture afterward, I guess is the question.
I depending on the course material, if it's very remedial and I got a lot of people taking their first course in a discipline, I might record it, but I put it up there only for a week. And then that gives them a chance to go back and listen to something, get clarification, adjust notes, and so on. But you have to be careful with that stuff. And the reason is because there are limitations in certain financial aid scenarios as to how many online classes someone can take. Now, online means online asynchronous. That's the kind where your interaction with the professor is basically grading and getting feedback on your assignments. It's not interactive like on Zoom. It's a separate animal. So there's a limit. The VA, for example, has a limitation on that. And so, you know, VA students have to take in-person classes. Zoom counts, in the classroom counts. Asynchronous online is counted as an online class. So
okay.
they have been known to interpret that if I publish the class and say watch it anytime you want, that's just another variation of an online class. And I don't want to get on the poop list with the VA and have them say, sorry, we're not going to allow people to take VA-supported classes at your school anymore. I ain't going to be the guy who causes that. So I will do it on a very, very limited basis. That probably pushes up against the edge of it, but does not cross the line.
Yeah, the reason why I ask is Audrey was talking to one of her neighbors who was, I think she teaches pharmacy school, is that? Do you guys have a pharmacy school? Or is a, who, or who has those things? Hospitals or anyway, she teaches in pharmacy.
No, there's some schools who specialize in pharmacy. It's like here in Michigan, Grand Valley State has a very well-known pharmacy program.
Really? Well, she was saying that they have that you know, kids always want to negotiate their grades these days, which I can't imagine that, but that just shows how old I am. They don't come to class, and they say, "Well, that's all right. I listen to it online or something." It can't be the same as being in there. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it is a little bit, but
it isn't, especially when I put interactive graded assignments in all of my classes. So you have to be in class to be part of that assignment, whether it's, you know, putting people into breakout groups, whether it's putting and giving them something to look up, report back to the class, whatever it is. I do that specifically because I want them in the classroom. And when I talk to students, there's only a few, there's a few things. When you ask them, what do you like about the classes you like and what do you not like about the classes you don't like? Well, one of the things is they want the stories. They want the experience of their professors. They say, I can read the material. That's no problem. I can cover everything that's in the textbook myself. And I do want you to touch on that. Now, I do want to make sure you clarify everything that's in there. I don't teach out of the textbook. I teach whatever the topic is for this week, for this module. I teach the same topic, but I prepare my own version of it so that they get a different perspective. But also, they want to hear the stories. They want to hear the stories of real life, things that you did in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Well, they want to know what it's going to be like when they go to work. And if it's a management class, even, they want to know some of the really difficult situations you've encountered. And you can only get that by really being in class, being able to ask questions about it. And hell, most of my students know they get me off topic and rolling on any of that all the time. So,
well, that's,
they figure that out pretty quickly.
I wasn't much of a hands up in class guy. They used to do that with Milton Friedman all the time. Because we took this course was not supply chain management, it was the economics of supply or something, or pricing, or I don't know. Everything was graphs all over the place, nothing but math and graphs, and he didn't really want to teach it, and nobody wanted to be in there, so it was a perfect match. So whenever you ask him about the economy or money supply, somebody would ask him, he'd wander off for 10 minutes, and he was happy to do it, and everybody was happy to listen, because matter of fact, he had a manuscript that he taught from, and he was so bored with it, he never finished the manuscript. It was never published. It was just a manuscript. But that's what he taught out of it, because he found so many other things that were more interesting while he was writing that he kind of gave up. How weird is that?
And I use PowerPoint and pictures, but the students will also tell you, don't give me these long, full PowerPoints and read them to me. I can read.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't. I just have a couple of bullet points, maybe a picture or maybe just a picture. You know, what I use them for is to keep myself on track. When I veer off track, where was I? Oh, yeah, look at that. Okay, now I remember.
Gee, maybe we could use some of those for the show when we veer off track.
Yeah, we probably could. Yeah.
when you see, last night I was actually talking to a couple of younger people, and real young, and they're starting in their careers, and one guy works for a firm down here, and the other one works for, it's OCC or CBOE, and they're kind of in compliance and stuff. And you know, it's Kevin, how many people do we have in compliance? I mean, we're getting our PTI Securities is getting their 3-year FINRA audit now. We've got 5 people at work here. We've got 6 auditors. All coming up with stuff they want to see. Do we really? I mean, it doesn't make them bad people. Doesn't mean they're not trying to do the right job. But what in God's name are they doing? I mean, what? Just thinking up stuff to mess with people. Not in their mind, it's not messing with people, I'm sure. But I mean, is this so overboard? And then there's other areas where people just seem to run around, do whatever they feel like. And yet other areas, people are. If you're under any kind of the gun, or people are looking at you, it's crazy. They have people on the trading floor now, what's left of the trading floor, that stand around the crowd and watch the proceedings, their regulators. We never had that when you could open outcry trade. Now you can't even do that. Well, you can You can connect, but the trade isn't a trade until you both put it through your little computers. The computers dance. What do these people do all day, Kevin? I mean, you go through these buildings downtown here, every one of them's got 3, 4, 5 security people just standing there. What would you do if you had that job? You just stand there. Thank God you're not armed. I mean, you're not probably going to try and break up a fight or anything. You're going to call the police, but what a waste of a human being. Or is it just me thinking that way?
No, it generally is a waste of a human being. It's a waste of people's time. It's not effective use of any resources. So yeah, I always have a lot of disdain for that. You mentioned compliance, and that's one of the things that never shows up in a textbook, like in an IT course. They don't talk about compliance. Well, hell, I worked for 40 years in almost 30 years in a compliance industry where I would see state auditors, FDIC auditors, Federal Reserve auditors. I would see, I'm missing somebody from the feds, I'm sure. And then our own audit firm. And then I would also have to deal with a lot of third-party audits for services that we bought. Making sure that the customer requirements are totally met. And then I also remember getting to one place and they said, oh, by the way, our PCI, our payment card industry audit is due. You should be able to just go ahead and take the questionnaire from last year, review it, and then you can sign it and send it. And I said, yeah, I'll review it. Well, I'm reviewing the previous one, and I keep going through and going, well, that answer's not true. That's a lie. We ain't doing that. So now you have yourself scrambling to write policy and procedure before, for something that's due like next week. And I have to write policy and procedure and say, guys, we're doing this. You don't like it too damn bad, but this is what we're doing, because I am not going to put my name on something that says, no, we don't do it. And I'm not going to put my name on something that says, yes, we do that when we don't. So, I don't think a lot of people understand the compliance aspect of any job. Now, I was in banking, you're in financial and trading, and so we have more compliance burden than most, but everybody has it, and that's totally left out of the equation. So when we talk about students want to hear the stories, they want to hear about that stuff. They want to hear what's really part of the job.
Well, it's when you look at efficiency in this country, and you look at, even comes down to everything, whether you have people from other countries coming in here and do work and all the things you do, it's, when you look at it, you wonder how efficient can we be, and it comes down to, could you have built the Golden Gate Bridge where every riveter had to have two people next to him watching them? I mean, there's some sort of everybody knows you have to check something, but do you really need everybody watching everybody? I mean, if you want to be gross, when you go to the can, do you need written procedures? Do you need two people watching you? I mean, imagine what the world would be like if everybody did, but we're almost going that way. And so, last time I checked, Kevin, it has to be 10 years ago, there was something like 300,000 people in this country in like some sort of security / law enforcement. You talk about police forces, you talk about the TSA, you talk about private security firms. I mean, the fact that, we have crime not only makes it dangerous for you and me, maybe more dangerous than if there wasn't any crime, obviously, but the absolute cost to the economy of that is dramatic, not just in the crime itself, in the, quote, people preventing crime or making people feel like they're preventing crime. I mean, how do you have 300,000 people that don't do anything, that are able-bodied, We worry about people, and they say, well, nobody can find somebody and get a job. Well, hell, they're all working at stuff. A lot of people are working at stuff. I mean, all these people I see in the Board of Trade every night, I walk over there, if I go to the Sirius Cafe or something, I see 3 or 4 people. They're young men and women, looking in good shape. What are they doing this? Doing something worthwhile. I mean, are we that afraid that people are going to storm every building? I mean, I guess we are, are we, if you and I live 100 years, are we still going to have people you know, giving people, you know, a cavity search at the airport. I mean, we didn't used to do that. I mean, all those people, there's like 60,000 TSA people or something. I mean,
So now we're so used to the intrusiveness that whatever comes next, it's just going to be, okay, here we go again.
And what have you accomplished? I mean, I don't know.
Very little. So when you think about it from a Spark business standpoint, Carl can chime in on this too, because he ran a business. He ran a small data center in his internet business, and you know, one of the, you have to have controls. You have to have controls that will identify when things fall out of line. You can't be perfect at it, but you certainly can catch most of it. And you have to build in auditability into what you do so that you don't have to watch every time someone picks up the left hand, does this, pick up the right hand, does that. You have to have the ability to have audits. You also have to, you do need, if you're running an operations team, you have to have standard operating procedures. That's important, because if all three of us operate under our own, just do it our own way, we're not going to be able to manage the productivity. We're not going to be able to control the quality. But what we will be able to do with standard operating procedure is have the ability to change it, have the ability to take good ideas, test them out, implement them when they're good ideas, and then modify your standard operating procedure. So SOPs don't have to be rigid, but they do have to give the right kind of guidance so that people can do good, consistent work. That's, you know, it's almost an intuitive process that where you say, well, yeah, duh, of course you have to do that, but people don't do it. So, and people don't follow them when you have them. So how do you make them easier to follow? How do you write procedures? Writing procedures is a whole interesting thing, because it gets into adult learning, how do adults learn, different learning styles, and so on. That's all baked into it too. So there's a lot more to it than just saying, well, write step one, step two. And you know, people are suck at procedure writing. Anytime you've ever bought anything that you had to assemble at home, you know the procedures suck.
Well, sometimes the directions suck.
Well, yeah, they do.
Just saying. So you're not coming here this week. You're going to come in here next week, this way.
Yeah, I'll be in town next week.
When you're feeling 100%.
Hopefully.
Yeah. All right, bud. We'll bring Carl on, and we'll talk at you next week, if not soon. I'll talk to you this weekend. Right, SP Futures down 5, NASDAQ Futures down 8. You want to bring Carl on right away, Ricky?
Sure.
Carl, you with us?
I certainly am. You know, I was listening to most of the first part of the show. Back in the day, actually not all that long ago, but during the so-called Great Financial Crisis thing, was when I started publishing my own blog. And for a substantial period of time until Obamacare came in, there was a contributor program where you could get enhanced access and some video content and stuff like that I hosted on my own equipment, which is, it's kind of expensive to do, because obviously you have to have, you know, the computer processing resources and also the bandwidth and things like that. It's not as simple as just, you know, publishing a blog or whatever, right? Costs a little bit more money. And so, but when Obamacare came in, I killed that because of that cliff, the subsidy cliff. And I just wasn't willing to take, you know, the second $25,000 and hand it to the government so that some guy who had taken absolutely zero care of himself could have me pay his MRI bill.
So
I became a non-taxpayer essentially for a long period of time, other than obviously capital gains and things like that, right? I turned this thing back on. In fact, it just went formally live yesterday, although I was testing it for a few days before that with a handful of guinea pigs. And, you know, one of the things that Kevin was talking about was, you know, he did banking, right? And he used a magic word, PCI, which I know a little bit about, because when I ran MCS, we used to handle our own credit cards. We had a formal merchant account. And so, you know, there are very serious rules if you actually take card numbers on in your business. Okay, not necessarily take charges. So like if you do it through Stripe or PayPal and they host the payment links and you never actually get the whole card number, you never get that three-digit code on the back. Okay, the really big one's that three-digit code. All right. But the number too, the whole number. You know, if you print the last four on someone's receipt or something, that's fine. But but if you actually handle that number, then you have a whole set of requirements and they will come in and audit. And by God, if you break those rules, you do not want to know what the fines look like, especially if a breach gets traced to you.
So okay. Is that why you'll buy some stuff from a place and you give them the credit card and you'll say, well, you guys already have it. So, I don't know. We don't keep any of them.
Well, the thing is, it's not... the compliance has to do with not just, you know, whether you take it, but also do you store it anywhere? All right.
Well, that's what I mean. So, they don't want to store it. They'll take it, and then that's it.
Well,
I'll run the charge through, but then they forget it, for lack of a better term.
Well, your bar, for example, you know, takes your plastic, right?
Yeah.
But it's ephemeral. It's in their terminal, and then it's gone. They don't log it anywhere. All right. And that is a much easier thing. That's, you know, then, okay, so whoever your processor is, you know, you buy the terminal, you connect it. 99% of the problem is on the processor there, right? But God help you if you hang on to that card number, because then you'd better be able to prove that it is securely stored.
And well, that's what Matty Weber's firm does for, like, restaurants and stuff. He said back when you used to, like, the Triple used to have one of these, they don't anymore, where they actually have the thing, the credit card thing, attached to the copper telephone wire.
Right.
He goes, that was absolutely idiot-proof. They'd run it there. No, you couldn't hack it. And maybe somebody could.
Well, yeah, because...
He said, once you put it in your cash register now, is takes your thing, uses, you know, does it that way. He says, now you have to have all kinds of procedures making sure you don't screw that up.
Well, now, yeah, and you know, one of the things, I mean, unfortunately, the enforcement isn't what it should be, okay, because I've had my card stolen a few times over the years, and I know a couple of times I've been able to pinpoint exactly where it happened. Now, that, from my being in the business where we actually took cards, and we charged recurring subscriptions. And so as a result, we had to keep them, right? Because we had to be able to continue to do that. And there's a real problem with doing that. Now, today, if you want to do recurring things, which I personally think they're a bad thing. I don't like them. The merchants love them because they rely on this thing that's in the industry, in all industries, it's called breakage, which is basically you buy something and then you don't use it. All right, that's free money to them. So, you know, the same thing with gift cards. If I buy a gift card for, say, Texas Roadhouse, and then I never go to Texas Roadhouse, you know, I just gave the company the money, and I ain't getting any food.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, companies...
Hey,
love...
I have a question for you. If you go to Myers or Target or someplace, and you buy the gift card there,
right,
how does that work?
So they have to account for it at the time it's purchased. So it's revenue, okay.
But like if I buy a Home Depot $100 gift card for somebody, it is a birthday present.
It's $100 of revenue to Home Depot.
Okay, to Home Depot, and then the other guys get a spiff or no?
Well, who gets a spiff?
Oh, does Myers? What do they make on it? 2% or something?
Well,
for selling
there's,
it.
Yeah, there's basically there's a kickback of, you know, I mean, it's not called that, but it kind of is. And most of those cards, so there's two kinds. There's ones that are actually, when you get down to it, what they amount to is they're a prepaid debit card that's run by the major card processing networks, even though they look like they're Home Depot's thing, okay? And that's because setting up all the infrastructure to do that, plus the clearing networks with the check stands and stuff like that, is actually a little bit complicated. And doing it correctly is, it's expensive. And so, you know, and Visa and MasterCard and these guys, they're experts at it.
Are the question I wanted to ask you, I was waiting until today to ask you, with this, yeah. Capital One taking over Discover, are they going to shut down Discover's processing?
No, would be my guess. So Capital One is kind of a funny company in that their target demographic, I mean, they'll give anybody a card. By the way, something just hit the tape. I don't know what it was.
Yeah, we just went flying. PC's not out yet. Something must be out.
Yeah, it's too early. That usually comes out at 8:30, so yeah. I'm not quite sure what it is. But yeah, something hit the tape. So Capital One has always kind of catered to the subprime credit card market. Okay, always.
Yep.
And I mean that's they're the guys that if you have a 500 FICO they'll give you a card. You probably won't like the terms.
Yeah. Well.
but they'll give you. I mean, and they make a lot of money.
But you have to have a card, like to rent a card or something. You're powerless without a card.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, which is crazy, but.
But they make a ton of money on people that pay 30% interest. Okay.
Can't you? Can't you actually, if you have zero credit whatsoever, can't you get a card where you give them $2,000 and then you have a card where you can charge $2,000?
Yeah, you can buy stored value cards with almost. I mean, not quite anonymously, but pretty close. And it looks like a Visa. If you've ever gotten a rebate, like, you know, you buy four tires, get $200 or whatever, that's what that is. It's a stored value card that's got the $200 on it.
Yeah, the thing is useless in a lot of places.
Well, the ones that actually come from the major processors and have, like, Visa or MasterCard's logo on them.
We're down 120 on this NASDAQ here, and I'm looking at all these headlines. I can't see what.
I don't know what did this, but yes, that was pretty interesting.
Well, you know what's wrong with those things? Because I had a... What the hell did I do? I got a $200 thing for Visa. Say you've got $40 left on it. All right. And you put it in the gas station, and you know you got 40. You're only going to put 40 in the tank. They have to clear, like, 100 or something, and they'll reject it.
Right.
Something's weird with that.
Yeah. There's two things that happen. There's two ways to play this game, right? Kind of, sort of. As a merchant, and I went through some of this because now I'm using Stripe now. Okay, now I used to take this stuff through PayPal because Stripe didn't exist at the time. Stripe allows virtually any kind of payment flow you want. When you, like, if you go to a gas station and you swipe your card at a gas station. If you've got instant notifications from your issuer, Discover's really weird about this too. So Amex does this the right way. Discover does not. They never have. So let's say you swipe your Amex card. You'll see that your phone will bing if you've got it set up for immediate notifications that they just authorized $150. Okay. Now, I've got a sedan. I can put 15 gallons in there if it's bone dry, right? There is not a snowball's chance in hell that I'm going to pump $150 worth of gas. But I might.
Well, there were
a
couple times at my 42-gallon Suburban when gas was $4, I got close.
Well, but see, that's the thing. I have a truck, right? Okay, so if I've got the truck and it's, and gas is $4 or $5 a gallon, all of a sudden, hey, wait a minute. You can, right? So that's the thing. Now, Love started grabbing like $2.50. A couple of years ago, which that can get you in some trouble. But then, so you have an authorization. Now, the reason they did this is because what they used to do at the gas stations is they'd authorize a dollar and then go ahead and just abandon that, ignore that, and put in a second transaction for the amount after you get done and you hang the nozzle back up. Problem with that is, what if I've got a card that only has $20, a stored value card. And by the way, the system does not know this. It just knows it's a debit card. Okay, they authorize a dollar,
Then I put $50 worth of gas in the car, and they go to charge it, and it's just...
Carol, I thought you were supposed to be the guy who gets these memos. We're now down almost 40 in the S&P and 150 in the NASDAQ.
I got the big red candle on my screen. I have no idea where it came from, okay? But I do see the big red candle.
Hey, do you want to... I was talking earlier, I'm trying to comment on it. I don't want to go over it too much, but we mentioned... Somehow or another, this is where I think there's a man behind the curtain, and it's not Trump, it's not Biden, and it's not some of these other people. Hale and I were going back and forth, I don't know if you were in there, we've been watching this money supply growth here start to shoot up again. And the last month it's reported, which is the end of April, which is so screwed up, but that's another story. Ours was 8.1% on an annual rate, which is higher than it's been in like a real long time, and it's not fighting any kind of inflation despite what Powell says. By the way, Powell met with Trump evidently yesterday, or the other day, and well, I can only imagine that conversation. But the ours is shooting up, and so I see this headline this morning, and India's growth was 7.1 instead of 6.7. Everybody's kind of cheering it, right? So, of course, me being the monetarist, I immediately dive for their money supply.
Of course.
And in the last year, they were up 9.4%. Now, the last three months, they're up at a 12% annual rate. The last 2 months, they're up at a 29% annual rate. So any number of the last quarter that you look at on a nominal number, to me, is absolutely useless in terms of what kind of... Are you going to deflate this thing 29% for... I mean, what exactly, all of a sudden now, it seems like several places around the world are now pumping money. Japan's doing it.
Yeah.
China's doing it. Is there some man behind the curtain that controls all this that we don't even know about, or what? Why does this seem this coordinated?
It probably because it is, right? Why do you think they make this, not one of the things that's trumpeted out every week when it gets...
Oh, here it is. President Trump, China has violated its agreement with U.S. on tariffs. So what, the Trump guys got to sell futures 20 minutes ago while we were looking for this, and now...
Probably, yeah. Well, you know, hey, listen, I wish I'd known, because I would have shorted a few of those E-minis.
And, yeah.
I mean, you know, hey, that would have been... A quick
40 points before breakfast is not bad.
I'm just saying, I've only got two espressos in me. I'll take 40 points before I get my third one down my throat.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
that'd be enough for me to go get some beer at the end of the day, right? I mean, even if it's only one contract.
Our concept of morality and right and wrong is getting so skewed now, I don't even know. It's almost like it's so blatant that if you're not cheating, you're not trying, and nobody even knows why you're complaining about it.
So anyway, what I was talking about with this thing with the gas stations, okay, and the cards, is what happens is they pull this authorization, then you pump the gas, and the way it's supposed to work is that if you pull an authorization, that locks the line but is not a charge, okay? So if I have, say, $500, I've got a shitty credit, credit score, and the best I can get is a card that has a $500 one. So I go and I swipe that card at the gas pump, and they pull a $250 authorization. Now my card only, even if it had nothing on it, now I can only spend $250 until that authorization gets released, because that is now a commitment by the issuer that says that $250 is available to you as that individual merchant.
Well, that's what happened to me on those gift cards, which made them kind of useless.
Right, and the problem is that they'll pull more than, like if you go into a hotel and it's, $200, they'll pull another $100 for, incidentals, or you smoked in the room or whatever. Well, guess what? If you don't have it, that bounces. So even though it's not a charge. Now, the problem that Discover has always had, and I suspect there's game playing that they do within their network, is that they, even though the transaction matches as soon as you hang up the gas station hook, they don't release that hold typically for 24 to 48 hours. And where this will get you in trouble, and I had a problem with this when I was traveling across the country, because I've got my trailer on the back of the truck, and I'm getting 9 miles a gallon, right? So I'm pulling into a gas station every 3 or 4 hours to fill the tank up.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Right, and the problem is, the networks also have a limit on how many outstanding authorizations you can have at one time, because it is an indication of fraud if all of a sudden 15 different places start trying to charge your card, right? So all of a sudden I go up to the pump and I swipe the Discover card and it's like, bah! Oh, what do you mean, bah? There's, you know.
Why don't you have a roll of Benjamin's cash, Denninger?
Well, so here's the thing. Amex drops the authorization instantly when the transaction goes through.
So they'll authorize $250, and if you only charge $25, they pull the $225 off.
Well, they don't pull it off. It matches. The way the network works is when the transaction posts, it is supposed to immediately drop the authorization that matches that authorization.
Well, if you pay your bill online with those guys, before you can get to your email, it's already there. They're pretty good.
Well, but Discover sits on those authorizations sometimes for 48 hours. And
when you pay them online, they sit on it for 48 hours.
They do that, too. Yeah. That's the other thing. It's like I get my Amex and my Discover, I have them set to close on the same day. Okay, the statements close on the same day. I pay them as soon as I get them because I use it as basically a charge plate, both of them. And every single time, Discover is typically 2 days behind before they credit it.
Oh, yeah. Well, easy.
And I'm telling you, you know, but this is the thing, Chief. If you skim a penny here and a penny there on the float, all right, this was the old scam with compound interest in accounts, savings accounts.
Yeah, that was back when people paid interest.
Well, but that was also back when you had passbooks and nobody would sit there and do the calculation for, the last 90 days and realize that they got screwed out of 4 cents, right? Well, 4 cents times a million accounts is all of a sudden real money. And so, this is all legal, but this is some of the stuff that goes on. And I don't know, I don't think Capital One is going to shut the Discover network down. They'd be crazy to do that because the competition in the networks is good. But what this does is this takes, for anybody that's on their stuff, since they now own the network, because Visa and MasterCard are a separate association. So Capital One has had to pay Visa and MasterCard, the networks, to clear their transactions. Now that they own Discover, they'll take the people that are good credit risks and they'll essentially convince you, probably with rewards or, a statement of credit, who knows what they'll use. But they'll come up with a way, or just a lower interest rate if you carry a balance. They will convince you to go ahead and move over there because they don't have to pay anybody else network fees on Discover transactions now.
Yeah, who does Capital One use? They're Visa, right?
I think they're Visa. Yeah, I don't know if they're Visa or MasterCard, but
I have a Capital One because that's who Bass Pro Shops uses.
Yeah, but both Visa and MasterCard, of course, are a separate network,
right.
and nobody works for free. So the reason Capital One wanted to do this was, number one, Discover, the people that hold Discover cards tend to have a little bit better credit profile. Discover's a little tighter. Amex is even a little tighter than that. But Discover's a little tighter. They don't cater to the schlub that has a 400 credit score. But the real 900-pound gorilla in the room is the network fees. And now they don't have to pay them for anybody that has a Discover card, because I mean they have to run the network, but they don't have to pay it to anybody else. It's theirs.
Hey, I was on you talk about audits, right? And how people, my issue with auditors, because we deal with them all the time, is that they have a bunch of young people dreaming up stuff for all the crimes that nobody commits anymore. And they don't have anybody looking forward to the crime somebody might commit tomorrow.
Yep.
And to me, so guess what they want yesterday? You're going to be on all over this, Carl.
Uh-oh.
They demanded 20 of my shows for somebody to sit there and listen to, for fear I might have said something wrong.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Do you know why I do my own, why I started doing this and I'm doing my own hosting? Because I got tired. So you know what, Spain just had this power outage, right? Not that long ago.
Yep.
The reason it happened is they had too much in the way of no flywheel generation, renewables, specifically solar. all right, because solar has no flywheel. And if you have an inverter and it gets out of phase because of sag as a result of heavy load, the two choices that that unit has is disconnect or be destroyed. Yeah. Right? I mean, that's just the way it is. And so what it's going to do is protect itself and disconnect. Well, now that, you know, the sun can be shining blazes, but if it can't connect, it's worthless. It's worth zero. So you have, and that causes a cascade because now it generates an overload in other parts of the grid. They disconnect, and the whole thing comes apart. This is something that I have talked about for a long time. Other people have talked about it for a long time. I'm not the only one who's figured this out. You get flywheel effects for free with coal and natural gas, nuclear, which is just a boiler. So you have a huge rotating generator, okay, and that thing has an immense amount of mass, and therefore it is a flywheel, and it resists being slowed down. So transient loads don't piss it off, and the system stays stable. You take the stability out when you go to solar because inverters have no flywheel. Now, you could buy basically a motor and a generator and hook it up to the grid and put a flywheel in where there isn't one, but now you're paying money for that, and you're not getting anything out of it. So, you know, they tend not to do that kind of thing. So I wrote an article about this and noted it. Google blocked it for advertising, claiming that it contravened their policy on anything that might have anything to do with climate.
It's unbelievable.
They blackballed it. And you know what? They've been doing this to me, Chief, they did this more than 10 years ago. I went low carb. I changed what I ate. I lost 60 pounds. All the metabolic degradation that had been going on as a middle-aged guy reversed. Okay, it all went away, and I wrote a series of articles on what I had done and what happened. I made no judgment on anybody else's decisions. I said this is what I did. These were the results. When I put in my blog at the time, all the way through the financial crisis, everything else was advertiser supported. It had Google's AdSense advertising on it. When COVID was going on, in the middle of that, they went back through my articles that were 10 and 15 years old and blackballed them from advertising.
Well, how do all these guys with the... Now, you're not even talking about a supplement. You're not trying to get any money.
No, I'm not selling anything.
How does somebody get on here and all of a sudden you see some guy with a big beer belly, not that I resemble that, and going, oh, man, if you just have our secret three scoops of honey and lemon juice before you go to bed, in 2 weeks you're going to have a six-pack. I mean, how does that get on and your stuff doesn't? I mean, you're doing is telling a story.
What I know, I know this is true on all the different social media sites, and it's also true in the ad networks. And the reason I know Google's doing it and the other ones are doing it is because I've caught them. There are backdoor APIs that the ordinary person cannot get at. And my system has the ability to track where these references are coming from. And there are references that are not, they're not something that you would ever see. So if you're clicking around the internet and you're looking at the link that comes up before you click the button, that's what people ordinarily see. But there are malformed versions of that, if you will, that the system understands what it is, will serve you the content, and logs it. It's basically a honeypot. It's kind of like if some telemarketer calls you or you go somewhere and you change your middle initial on the name you give them, and then you see that show up somewhere else, you know who sold that information to someone. All right?
Yeah.
And if you keep track of this stuff, you can track this stuff down. Well, these are things that never showed up anywhere in any public place. And therefore, I know that there is a backdoor reporting mechanism that these organizations have, and there are people running around using it. Now, I don't know who's using it to report it, but my suspicion is that some of it is AI-driven, and some of it is also driven by farms of people who are paid by various special interest groups that have a little shadowy backdoor relationship with these entities, and they go find it. That's their job, is to go find this stuff and blast it and try to get it taken off the air. And this has been going on. It really got ridiculous during the time of COVID. And it is not backed off one.
Well, they had massive support. I know a doctor who'll go nameless that was not into the shots, and I think every doctor in Illinois got a letter. I don't know about every, saying something to the effect that if you go on any kind of media saying that the shots are not a good idea, we're going to pull your license. Was that?
Oh yeah, no, that kind of stuff was. Yeah, that was very blatant. But this is very shadowy, okay? But it is real. And anybody that thinks it's not, I have proved it.
Well, you know, Carl, we're going to go to break here, but I'll lob this one in. Plus, when I was on Joel's show yesterday, they asked me some questions, and I just wanted to see what your answers would be, kind of the same questions, because they dig in more for investment advice, which, of course, I agree with FINRA. I don't want to give investment advice to people that I don't know, because if I'm not seeing your stuff, I'm not seeing your, you know.
Well, you can't without individual knowledge.
Right, so. But there's some general platitudes that you can lob out at people. But you know it's funny to me is if you look at the two most diametrically opposed political people that I could see in the world today, one is probably President Trump, and one is probably the mayor of Chicago.
Yeah, I would say that's probably true.
And yet, being somebody who always looks at things. That's why I love jealousy with people on the show. We all are a group of, I'll use the term cats, that look at things differently than most people, or at least more in more depth.
Yeah.
I listen to those two people all the time, and I look at what they've done. They are the exact mirror images of each other.
Oh, yeah.
It's their way or the highway. They only hire people around them that are loyal to them, and they don't care if they're talented or all. And anybody who is against them is immediately an enemy, and not just somebody who has a different point of view. They are the exact same people, just on opposite ends.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at their personalities and the way they think and the way they act, exactly the same. An ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of talent for both of them, right?
Yep.
And if the person doesn't like me, he's out. You know, it's almost scary, and they're always right. Both of them don't seem to have any of the history or education that you would expect. They're not Churchill. Either one of them. And yet they have an opinion on everything.
Here's one of the things, though. I mean, you know, it's all fun to bag on Google, and you know, because they're Meta or X and, you know, Musk or whatever. But here's the reality of this. In any advertising area, it's not them. Because the companies that buy that advertising are the ones that are driving that show.
Yeah.
And if they decided that they didn't want it, they would set up their own ad network and they'd tell Google to stuff it, and Google's stock price would go in the toilet.
Oh, yeah.
All right? So obviously this is coming from the companies. And the problem is this kind of indirection and concentration is supposed to be illegal. Remember I talk about 15 USC a lot, right? Well, guess what? They just got found, they were found guilty not long ago of violating that law. Of course, not criminally, because we don't put anybody in jail anymore. But, you know, all of a sudden, you know, now people are talking about breaking them up and, you know, da, 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 da. Yeah, okay. How about this? How about, because the damage that's done to people, and it's all diffuse. It's a dollar here, it's a dollar there. But if you take it across the entire, I mean, you know, you look at the amount of content that I can't put on an advertising-supported site today, that I write about, all right? I mean, if I start talking about, if we had another financial blow up and I start saying, hey, you know, all these crooks that packaged up all these securities that they were calling vomit on their own internal communications, and they're selling to clients as good investments, okay? If I, that's what got me blackballed on all the national.
Well, Carl, we got to break, but what you're saying is they're essentially, if you go back to the old days when the Tribune had the huge hunk of advertisement,
it's a company town.
In the middle of the paper,
yeah.
That you would give Sears the right to say you can't put this letter to the editor in there because it might criticize Sears. That would never have happened 40 years ago.
Yeah, but now it does.
Now it does. And what you're saying is way more sinister than you're describing it or how you can understand just by listening to it. It's way more sinister.
Oh, you bet it is. And it's going on every day.
Yeah. SP Futures down 19. NASDAQ Futures down 68. So whoever got whatever the news was early, I hope they covered, because you made 100 and some instead of on NASDAQ. You made, now you'd only be up 20 in the S&P. So you really want to make 40, not 20. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. As you all know, the broad markets, especially tech, have been hot for a while. Lots of reasons. New technology, small fixed income returns, a lot of Fed cash, maybe some good management. Recently, however, the rates on fixed income investments, even U.S. Treasury, have risen from the very low levels. Treasuries are more attractive. There might even be some interesting bonds out there. Also, the bull run has some leading stocks with historically high valuations, maybe making long-only positions a little riskier. So what to do? I think the answer is flexibility. The market may keep going higher. It may not. It could even go down. Is fixed income a thought for some part of the portfolio? Rates are not zero anymore. You may want to protect some gains. Think about some rebalancing, address some growing concentration issues, maybe thinking about commodities. We at PTI may have a solution just right for you. Open an account at PTI Pro Direct, PTI's online trading platform using the Interactive Broker high-end platform. There you will find competitive rates and solid execution across all product lines and traditionally high interest on money balances. In addition, at any time you can seamlessly decide for fixed income investments to access Dan Janitas at Kratos Capital for management services. Dan and his team work tirelessly to achieve the highest returns they can in whatever risk category you are comfortable with. You can also quickly access my team for investment services and a wide array of investment strategies on the security or commodity side, protective strategies, concentration issues, or straight long. In one place, you'll be able to be flexible and ride whatever the future market holds with people you are used to hearing and trusting every day. Need help? You got it. Don't need help? That's okay, too. You'll have a great self-management platform with help always available. This market can change on a dime. I believe, like everyone else, having the right people there if needed is the way to go. Call me at 312-663-4310 or email me at time@ptisecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 22, NASDAQ Futures down 69. The PCE just came out. It slipped to 2.1 in April. Out of all the things that the government puts out, this thing pisses me off probably more than anything. It's the Fed preferred gauge. Nobody gets any backup. Nobody gets any detail. Nobody gets anything. This number could be 10 or minus 5, and nobody would know the difference that I can sort of understand. I know it's being a little harsh, but that's the way I feel today. What can I tell you? The Dow futures down 155. Individual stocks in the Dow, nothing crazy here. We've got everybody's kind of red, but Salesforce down $1.72. We've got Chevron Texaco down 79 cents, Goldman Sachs down 185, but nothing crazy. American Express down 185, Amgen down 189, but nothing like 10 or 12 bucks or anything, at least at this point. Euro, DAX up 121. It was up more than that the last time we checked, but still up 0.5%. FTSE up 37.3%. CAC RON has turned negative a little, negative 2, call that flat. So they're down some from what they were an hour ago. Nikkei down 467, that's 1.2%. Hang Seng down 283, 1.2%. Shanghai down 15.5%. This is a combination, I guess, of our guys acknowledging that the negotiations with China have hit a deadlock of some kind, and the appeals court turning around the tariff thing. So tariffs are back on, at least for the moment. Yesterday, S&P was up 23 after being up like 80 in the morning. NASDAQ up 74 after being up in the middle 200, so we kind of crept back down there to close. Bonds up 1 basis point, 4.33, that's a 10-year rate. The Bund up 1 basis point, 2.53. Japan down 2 basis points, 1.50. I'm going to ask Carl to comment a little bit on this carry trade thing that some people are starting to worry about. Yet another little landmine out there nobody thought was there. Oil down 43 cents, 60.51. Rent down 29 cents, 63.86. Natural gas down 3 cents, 3.48. Gold, which was getting hammered pretty good earlier, is only down 13 now. It's down almost 30. So it's come back a little bit with this latest announcement of the PCE. Silver only down 10 cents. It was down almost 30. 33.31. Foreign exchange, virtually nothing changed there. The euro's at 113 and the pound's at 130. Matter of fact, the pound is unchanged. Crypto, Bitcoin's quiet today, down $83. Still, 105.771. What do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Morning, Chief, and happy Friday. It's currently 7:38 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. 60 degrees right now with a high of 78. Partly sunny and warm, becoming breezy this afternoon, possibly with a thunderstorm. Tonight might be rainy, otherwise partly cloudy with a low of 51 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 66 right now with a high of 105. How with periods of clouds and sunshine. Tonight will be clear to partly cloudy and warm with a low of 78 degrees. Traffic in Chicago. Emma Kennedy from Monroe's looking at 31 minutes. 48 minutes. Iman Edens from Lane Cook. Iman Eisenhower from Wolf, 38 minutes as well. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 25 minutes. Inbound Stevenson from 24 to the Dan Ryan, 39 minutes. Talk about sports. NHL Conference Finals Game 5 yesterday. Oilers beat Stars 6-3 and they win the series 4-1. They're preparing for the Stanley Cup Final against Panthers this Wednesday. Next Wednesday, June 4th. NBA Conference Finals Game 5 yesterday. The Knicks beat Pacers 111-94. Indiana still holds the lead though with 3 wins against Knicks 2. Game 6 is Saturday, May 31st. That's tomorrow at 7 p.m. Lastly, MLB. Today we got Reds at Cubs at 1:20 p.m. White Sox at Orioles 6:05 p.m. and Nationals at Diamondbacks at 8:40 p.m. Back over to you, Chief.
So, Carl, you all charged up about PCE that we can go through in detail? Oh, wait a minute. We can't, can we? Do we have Carl?
Oh, wait. You mean it's, that black box that we can't see? You got to love the dial twisting nonsense on that stuff. I'll tell you where I think they're getting it from, because I, just in my daily life, I see prices, right? Eggs have come down some, okay? Trump was touting them. I'm like, wait a minute, where's my 99 cent a dozen ones that I had a couple of years ago? They're not $9 a dozen. Now they're only $6. Okay. And the other thing that is actually, has a real impact on people is that, for reasons I don't quite understand, usually this goes the other way. Fuel came down quite a bit in the last couple of weeks. Normally, exactly the opposite thing happens, because you shift to the summer blend, and on top of that, everybody wants to take advantage of people that are on the road for Memorial Day, right? So let's jack up the price a little bit. But that's not what happened this time. So that was kind of interesting, and I'm sure that goes into the number. Because everybody buys gas, right? So, well, not everyone. If you have an electric car, you don't buy gas. But
and you don't pay taxes.
In Tennessee you do, because they bend you over the table for the taxes on your tags, which is what they should do, because you don't pay it at the pump. I pay it at the pump. And my truck is heavier than my car. It does more damage to the road. Okay, it gets crappier gas mileage, which means I pay more every time I fill up the truck.
Well, that's the logic to it. It's the logic to it.
Yeah, and that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. If I had a Prius, the Prius is lighter, would be lighter than my Mazda, and does less damage, and I use less gas, and I pay less tax, right? That seems it's indirect and it's not precise, but it's close enough, right? The guy that has a Tesla doesn't pay anything.
And the gas tax in Illinois, especially if you're in the city, is pushing 93 cents.
Well, federal's 53, I think.
No, it's not.
I thought it was.
I'll dig it. I just had it up here, but it's a.
Oh, that might have been federal and state in Tennessee, because
I'll dig it up here, because
Indiana raised theirs during the middle of COVID when nobody was driving and gas was so cheap, and they figured, nothing, that'll never hurt anybody.
Well, their revenue was so far down.
Well, yeah, exactly. But RBOB is trading 202 right now.
Right.
Okay. So, and that's a fairly, you look at that chart over the last couple of weeks, and it's from the upper left to the lower right, and that is exactly the opposite of what usually happens right around Memorial Day. So.
Yeah, we'll get the, what is Illinois again changing me a little bit? Effective July 1st, 2024, things went back up. Where are we here? I'll dig it out. The Illinois gas tax rate is now 47 cents a gallon. I think the state's like The Illinois Part B motor tax rate. Anyway, because there's a county, there's a city. The federal, I think, is like 12.5.
No, federal's 18.4.
Well, okay, they're 18.4.
And diesel's 24.4.
But the city, the Illinois is so unique in that their sales tax is also on the other tax. That's always
nice when they do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so the total's like 93 cents.
Yeah, they tax the tax. Isn't that pleasant?
Yeah. But hey, I was on with Joel, and they were talking just about what about the economy, right? Now, there's people right. that I don't normally know, so I sort of have to be a little careful. But there's several principles that I think you need to keep aware of. One is, what is a general market level vis-a-vis risk?
Right.
And where you are. And the two things I would always, or three things I would tell people to do is look at your portfolio, kind of put a date on your portfolio and when you put it together. You know, you might have stocks in there for 10 years. All right.
Right. Sure.
And then maybe put your age then and your age now.
And
are you still working? Are you, you know?
Right.
And those kinds of things. The other thing is really ask yourself the question. If it's say you got $500,000, $1,000,000, $100,000, $50,000, whatever it is. If none of that existed and somebody gave you a check for the money today, would you race to the broker or you're online, whatever the hell you're doing?
Where would you buy what you have?
Yeah, would it duplicate? And I don't really want to hear any bull crap about, well, taxes, this and that. But I'll say this, Carl. If I had a dime for everybody who didn't make the proper trade because of taxes, I'd be the wealthiest man I know.
Chief, some of the biggest mistakes I've ever made trading are trying to sit, on something I bought, say, today, right?
Yeah.
And the end of the year is coming up. Well, if you don't hold it for a year, it's ordinary income, right? To non-professional traders, to ordinary schlubs. If you hold it for a year, you get capital gains treatment. So that can be a fairly, let's say that I have made a really good decision and I got a triple. I got a three bagger.
Yep, yeah.
All right. And by God, boy, does that feel good. But I do not want to pay ordinary income tax rates on that. And so I'm going to sell that thing in January.
Yep.
And in the middle of December, they announced that, there's an investigation into our accounting. Bam, it's all gone.
Well, yeah, I mean,
the thing is, and you know what? All that money was mine. All I had to do was push the sell button, but I had to pay the taxes.
Well, you know, before there were indexes, and I love using the indexes because I get, you used to be able to get diversified right away. Now if you buy the Qs.
But you get some insulation from single stock blow-ups.
Except when you start getting the Qs, where 50% of it's five stocks, you lose some of that.
Not so much today. Right, not so much today.
Yeah, well, not so much in 2000 either. How'd that work out?
Well, exactly. Yeah. In 2000, it was the same sort of problem, right?
Well, so, and I said one of the hardest conversations, and these guys were loving it when I was talking about this. I said one of the hardest conversations is if you forgot about the index stuff and somebody came into me or any other money manager 5 years ago, and they say, "Well, here's $1 million. I want to be diversified. Let's put 50 grand in 20 stocks." Okay,
right.
Well, it's never been my bailiwick picking the 20 stocks, but suppose I picked up Cranes or I picked up somebody and, Investor's Business Daily, and we picked, here's 30 stocks, and between me and the client, we picked out 20, right?
Right.
Which I never like to do because I know there's going to be a clunker in there somewhere, and I don't want, whatever. But say we did it. Well, no matter what, at the end of 5 years, we're going to have some nice winners. We're going to have a few that were being... We probably gonna have a couple of clunkers, and now when you go to rebalance, you probably should do this every year at least. But let's say at the end of 5 years, you'll say, "Wow, we were smart enough to buy Nvidia 5 years ago. We were smart enough to buy this one 5 years ago, or blah blah blah." And by the way, we were dummies. We bought this oil company, and it hasn't moved, or it actually is down. Or say we bought Schlumberger or something. The thing went straight down. But at the time, it was probably You don't want to leave the oil business out of it, do you? I mean, so you buy some Schlumberger. And now, what you really need to, you're trying to talk somebody into doing is, well, we need to lighten up on this NVIDIA, not because we don't like it, or not because of anything, but now our portfolio doesn't anything look like 20 stocks even. We've got, you know, what this one's now 25% of the, it's a huge winner, but it's now 25% of the portfolio, which is great. And you're saying, oh, wait a minute, you want me to sell my winners and buy more of the losers? I'm not exactly putting it that way, but I'm saying our goal originally was to be diversified, and now we're not. Now, we can do this many different ways. Maybe we can protect some of the NVIDIA. So even if it drops, I'm just using that name because it's been one of the biggest winners.
Right.
But maybe we can protect that by doing some puts or something where we can at least, if it goes back down, we're not losing that chunk of the portfolio. It can get very complicated, but the conversation, they have people, wait a minute, you want me to sell my winners and buy more of the losers? What the hell kind of analyst are you? Well, our goal, you know, obviously, the best thing in the world is to pick the biggest winner this year and to be 100% into it. Duh. I get that. I mean, I'm not that dumb. But how do you do that? I mean, it's...
Okay, I'm not that smart.
Yeah, that's right.
Which means I don't pull that off all that often.
Right. I mean, matter of fact, have we ever picked the one best stock coming up the next year and put all our money into it? Do you know anybody who's ever done that? Maybe I'll bet there were people when Apple was trading $5 that just liked the product, might have bought 500 shares of Apple at $5 25 years ago, and
see,
maybe.
Chief, there's always here's the thing that I always tell people: there is always somebody who catches every corner.
Yep.
Okay. The problem is that they end up all over CNBC, all right, and now Fox Business, all right, because Fox had to do their thing with that. The fact that they did that does not make them the smartest guy in the room. It just means they were the lucky. Somebody buys a winning Powerball ticket once in a while too. That doesn't mean that you should listen to them on what numbers to play.
Oh, speaking of which, there's a couple. I don't know if they're, when I say a couple, there's a couple of people in Texas. I don't know if they're married. But allegedly, have won pretty good sizes in a lot. On the lottery, like 4 and 5 times.
Yeah, something's funny there, isn't there?
And that's what they claim. They claim that last thing you want to do is just go in and get random numbers. That there are patterns, and that they, and they, you know, obviously they must play a lot, and obviously it's more of a job than just going and buying some tickets.
Right.
But they claim there are patterns, and that's why they've won 5 times. It isn't just that they were randomly lucky. Boy, you know, I how the hell could that be? I mean, I wouldn't be a bit surprised that it did turn out that way, but how could that be? I mean, you would think it would be somewhat random.
Yeah, so here's the thing. You know, the games go to a lot of trouble to make sure that all the balls, I mean, they get a micrometer out and measure them. And, you know, in a picogram scale and, you know, things like that, right? Because small differences, very small differences in the circumference and the mass and whatever are going to, I mean, because, you know, you put the balls in the tumbler and it tumbles and they come out, right? So very small differences will change the probabilities. Now, it's supposed to be a completely random distribution. That's the way that the game's supposed to run. Is it? Well, maybe it is and maybe it's not, but the level of attention to those things can certainly skew the results. Now, how predictive that is is an open question. I've seen people claiming that you throw this problem at a computer, which is really good at sorting things. I mean, that's what computers do, right?
They're good at.
They're really good sieves. I just chased this integration problem with this stuff over here yesterday. I had a couple of transactions that didn't post correctly. And, you know, you ask the computer, all right, you know, sieve this for me, and it tells me, okay, oh, it belonged to that guy. Then I go figure it out and I fix it, right? That's what computers are really good at doing. Doing it by hand would have, oh, my God. I can't
well, you
imagine
could,
how long it would.
If you kept track of them. When I say
right.
You put in your computer,
but that's the idea.
But is it as simple as the last 100,000, 10,000 midday and end of day lottos? There should have been, you know, 525s, and in fact there were 625s. Is it?
Yeah.
Is it that? I mean, is it that? Is that what somebody's doing essentially?
Well, yeah, that's essentially what they're doing, is they're taking the numbers that do come up, okay, and throwing them into a database, and then doing correlation analysis, which is, I mean, that's what computers are really good at.
But it should come out to, I mean, it's never going to be even, but if there ought to be 2,000 of each number, one should be like 1980, and the other, I mean, it should be like really close.
Well, that's, yeah, the point is there shouldn't be a pattern.
Right.
Okay? If there's a pattern, there's a problem. There's not supposed to be one. And if the game is clean and it's being properly policed, there isn't a statistically valid one.
Well, you know, we had a guy on the show, might have been before Carl, that wrote a book on how crooked the lottery is and all the scratch-offs.
Oh, that was, well, that's an interesting game, because if you happen to have inside, if you have a thing inside where the tickets are being printed, yeah.
Well, he okay. was, you know they topped off for a while, at least the places I never buy one, but I look every once in a while just for the show. They topped off at $35. Now they have a $50 scratch off.
Oh, that's, yeah, no, they've got some. Yeah, they got some pretty crazy stuff. I mean, it's.
Well, his point was, say there's 10,000 of them out there. I'm just using a number.
Yep.
If there's five or six winners, say in the first 2,000, all the winners come out, they still sell all the rest of them, knowing there's no winners left with the thing that's saying that there are winners and there aren't. But that's probably not as bad as if you sell the first 8,000 and none of the winners come out, they pull the rest of the game.
Well, now in Florida, and I don't know about Tennessee, because I generally, I don't pay a lot of attention to lottery, but Florida, if you go onto their lottery page for all the different scratch-off tickets, they'll tell you how many of the top prizes are still outstanding.
Maybe it's a response to this guy's book or something. Originally, yeah, they didn't
might,
do
it
that.
It might be, because you can actually go on to Florida's lottery site. You know, they've got tickets that they put out originally for like last Christmas, right? You know, holiday $25,000 giveaway. They're still selling them because they haven't, all of the top prizes.
So some of them, if you do this study, you might actually find one or two where your expected return is more than your price.
Then and I mean, if you analyze this on a continual bit, but I mean, like there's a couple of them that are out there that I just happened to look at the site a little while ago. I know these were tickets that I think were issued in like October or something for like the coming Christmas season. There's still two or three of the top prizes outstanding, which means the game isn't closed. They're still selling those tickets.
Really.
So you could go into a Florida lottery store and buy one of those scratch-offs, assuming that, the store you go into still has them. And you actually still have a shot at getting the $25,000.
All right, hey, well, we have a few minutes, but the other question those guys were asking me was just general market fabric. And I was just saying, I've never in my lifetime, other than maybe the Iraq War, where you were watching the news pretty much live while you were trying to trade,
right.
I've never seen as many landmines. You see stocks that you think might be overvalued, market might be overvalued, then you see these guys pouring money into the system in the last 2 months, which if they pour 25% of money into the system, unless the long-term rates, which they've been pretty good at keeping down, go right. flying up, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if the market's up 25% and even more overvalued. But now, Then you hear about the Japanese, the carry trade. Those interest rates are going up so much, are they going to repatriate some of that money? Because the Japanese, because they pay no interest, a lot of their money is propping up other countries. $3.7 trillion is outside their borders invested.
Well, there's a huge risk there, because any kind of treasury can be levered at stupid numbers.
Well, and then you look at that. You look at the Chinese, we're bound and determined, and I'm not saying we're wrong, to mess with the Chinese, which of course we probably should, because they're trying to build stuff to conquer people. That's but I mean, how much and how, that's kind of above my pay grade. But the bottom line is, there's a lot of money there, and a lot of money of our people that are in there. And if you totally bury them, you can't come to a conclusion that nobody's going to be bothered by it, because I think we are. Right. I mean, it just seems like there's our deficit. We got a president comes out and says, by the way, it is the biggest beautiful bill ever, is going to save us $1.7 trillion, and the government accounting office says it's going to cost us $7 trillion. Okay, well, that's a $9 trillion swing.
That's a hell of a swing.
Yeah. And then you've got, you know, tariffs. Well, that's going to be a $400 billion tax. Oh no, they're off. Oh no, they're on. And you know, who's going to pay? I've never seen this many variables in the air ever. You know,
But Chief, this is always what happens at the end of a mania. Okay, do you remember 1999?
Oh yeah.
Okay, what was the story at the end of 19? Now these guys were out there; they were issuing IPOs. You know, I wasn't just a spectator in this, because when I made the decision to sell the company, I had the investment banker guys that they were all gung ho. Let's do the red herring, file the S-1, take the company public, blah blah blah. You know, right? And I kept looking at this, and I'm like, I'm reading all these things. Because at the time I was getting them. I had a DLJ account back when DLJ, Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jeanette were still around. And
that's who I traded with almost exclusively in the OEX bit to Pershing.
Well, so did I. Yeah. During that time, I mean, they were my broker for a long time. And I'm reading all these S1s, and I grab my HP12 and start adding this stuff up. I'm like, hey, wait a minute, these guys are claiming the, you know, like 10 times the global GDP in over the next, you know, 5 years.
Oh, yeah, if you extend it out, like 10, I'm 10 like, of the firms. I said,
this is going to blow up in everybody's face. I don't know when it's going to blow up, but it's going to.
We would have, for those guys to grow as fast as they said they were going to, we would have needed to annex another planet.
Well, I think we would have had three or four. But
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm like, this is not possible. And so, the you know, at some point, but that's the kind of thing we're seeing now. And we're seeing the same thing. You know, now Elon has left the administration. Now he's bitching about the fact that his $7,000 tax credit for buying a Tesla is going to go away, and this big, beautiful
bill. Well, he's also complaining that all the money he thinks he saved from Doge are pissing right back away through his bill.
Well, and they are.
Yeah, which they are.
But by the way, that's not a false claim.
Well, but it's just different people. It's a question of who gets the check and who gets the dinner, right? And
well, yeah. By the way, I am out of pocket next Tuesday.
You're toast Tuesday? Okay.
I'm toast Tuesday, but I will be around Friday.
All right, fair enough. SP futures down 24, NASDAQ futures down 80. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.